Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what's behind a growing fight over signs at this country's national parks and monuments?
And we meet a mother-daughter duo in the next installment of our Made in Arizona series.
But first, it's over 110 and school is starting across the valley this week. Kids across the state are saying goodbye to long summer days, camps, road trips, and cookouts. But as summer vacation comes to a close, we're bringing you one last conversation about its value, or lack thereof, for some students. Tim Daly is CEO of Ed Navigator, as well as the author of the Substack, The Education Daily. I spoke with him more about the paradox of summer vacation for kids and its growing inequality.
It's a persistent myth that summer vacation is scheduled so kids could work on farms. And in reality, it was quite the opposite. It started because East Coast cities were crowded and hot in the summer, and families that had the money to do so wanted to leave the city and take their kids to seaside destinations. Huh. And so that was the origin of summer vacation. It wasn't about farming kids at all.
Right. Okay. So you say progressive educators said, you know, this isn't fair. We need to let kids who aren't rich basically play outside in the summer as well. And the summer break is born.
That's exactly right. And it was kind of the intent was to give all kids the same experience, so to speak, that rich kids had.
Interesting. But you argue that that's never been the case, that rich kids have always had the upper hand when it comes to summer and in lots of ways kind of been the only ones who benefit from it.
That's right. It's never worked for families that don't have means because parents are frequently working and activities cost a lot of money. Vacations cost a lot of money. And so for the most part, sleepaway summer camps and other great opportunities that we often associate with summer vacation, those are largely available to upper middle class and wealthy families and pretty inaccessible to lower income families.
Yeah. So I want to talk more about that in a moment, but let me back you up for just a second and talk about the trade-off in summer breaks, right? Like, is it mm-hmm. worth it? Do we have any data on whether or not we should even have summer breaks if kids are losing too much in progress in mm-hmm. education in that time?
It's a really interesting question because kids do lose some ground academically. Some kids can afford to lose a little bit of ground because they're in really good shape. So they lose a bit in the summer, they gain a bunch of really interesting experiences, and then they come back in the fall and pretty quickly they make up the ground that they lost. It's a more difficult question for kids who are behind because there is really good research suggesting that when students are academically behind and they participate in high quality summer programming, it's a great way to catch up. So I think it's fair to describe summer as a trade-off. And you could argue that getting to participate in summer jobs and cultural experiences like going to museums and maybe doing sleepaway camp make it worthwhile. But it's most worthwhile for kids who are academically in pretty good shape and who don't need summer to catch up.
Right. You mentioned summer jobs, and I want to pause there for a moment because mm-hmm. you point out something really interesting in your piece that surprised me about summer jobs, that you assume that kids who don't have as much money are the ones working summer jobs, but you said that's actually the opposite.
That's exactly right. Kids who are most likely to have employment during the summer are wealthy kids because they're the ones who are able to, for example, have transportation to where their employment takes place. And jobs also require things like recommendations and resumes and things like that. And teen employment has been dropping for decades. So teens today are much less likely to work during the summer or the school year than kids a few decades ago.
Interesting. So let's talk then about what this looks like for those kids who aren't from wealthy families. Like, what do they end up doing with their summers?
They spend an enormous amount of time on screens. That's a pattern that's emerged over the last 10 or 15 years. We talk a lot about the concern with rising screen time for children and adolescents, and it's very much tilted. Lower income kids spend much more time on screens than higher income kids. And in the summer, the least expensive activity is to just be inside and either on a computer or a tablet or a phone or watching TV. So I think the number one thing is lots of screen time.
It's interesting because here in Arizona, I mean, summers are incredibly hot, right? So,
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
like, you can't even let kids go outside and play in the way that, you know, you might not be able to let kids go outside and play in the winter on the East Coast.
Right,
And
right.
lots of cities are getting hotter. Like, it's becoming less safe for
Yes.
kids to play outside all the time, whether or not they're in the middle of the desert like we are. Do you think that
Yes.
could make summers less enriching for kids who aren't rich going forward?
Yes, absolutely could make a difference. And I think the kinds of summer activities that are positive are typically structured and they're social. So it's not, you know, kids inside by themselves. It's groups of kids playing team sports together, taking trips together. Those sorts of things are really rewarding. And to the degree that extreme heat makes it harder for families to do anything but just keep their kids inside, I think that probably is a risk factor going forward.
And we should mention at the same time, the price of formulating a summer plan for your kids has just
Yes.
shot up, right? Like whether it's, you know,
Yeah.
expensive travel, but even just day camps.
That's right. It's over the last couple of decades, wealthier parents have just poured more and more money into their kids in many different forms. They pay lots of money for academic enrichment. They pay for their kids to play on travel sports teams, and they pay more money for things like summer camps. So the gap between the haves and the have-nots when it comes to summer has only gotten bigger because there is this market out there for really expensive summer activities that are out of the reach of most families.
All right, so then let's talk about solutions, potential solutions, which you have some ideas for, whether it's subsidizing programs that wealthy kids get to do and letting other kids go to them as well, job programs, scholarships, et cetera. What are some of the ideas on the table?
We absolutely should have more employment opportunities for kids beginning at age 13, 14, 15. And some cities are investing in that. The research has shown that when kids are employed during the summer, not only do they earn more money, but they seem to pick up habits that make it less likely for them to be chronically absent from school the next year and less likely to drop out. One thing to think about is how to subsidize local employers to take on more teen employees for those short-term summer months.
Yeah.
That can be done in lots of different ways, but I think one objective certainly should be more kids in the workforce.
Okay. You also dropped the V word. What are summer
Yes.
vouchers?
So in the new federal bill that was passed this summer, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, there is a substantial federal subsidy for education scholarships, so essentially vouchers. And states have to choose to participate in that program. Some states will probably choose to do it, and some states won't. It's a little bit different than state-level vouchers because this would be all federal money. And an open question is whether states could choose to use those vouchers specifically for summer programming. So there are certainly states that are unlikely to adopt traditional vouchers, generally blue states like New York or California or Illinois. They're probably not going to be interested in participating in a traditional private school subsidy program. But it's not clear right now that they couldn't elect to accept those vouchers and restrict their use just for summer. And if they did that, they potentially could provide pretty lucrative vouchers worth several thousand dollars each to every family with school-aged children. That would almost instantly level the playing field in terms of affordability for summer activities.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Tim Daly is CEO of Ed Navigator, author of the Substack, The Education Daily. Tim, thank you for joining us. Appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, Lauren.
As part of an executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, the Trump administration is targeting signage in federally managed historical sites like parks and national monuments. The administration's stated goal is to cover or remove sign text that, quote, inappropriately disparages Americans past or living, end quote. Supporters of the existing signage say that's an attempt to rewrite history. And now a group of concerned librarians and historians is attempting to counter the administration's efforts. Their project is called Save Our Signs. And our co-host Sam Dingman spoke with one of its founders, Molly Blake.
So there's copy on your website that says something to the effect of America's national parks are like a large open-air classroom.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about what's behind that statement.
Yeah, so there are over 470 national park sites across the country. And we're talking about national parks, but we're also talking about national monuments, national historic sites, national battlefield sites. Those all fall under that umbrella. Each site has a congressional mandate to tell the history of that site. And these sites have been chosen really carefully to reflect different aspects of American history. I know in your state of Arizona, you have sites that preserve Native American history and culture dating back 700 years. Mm-hmm. There are stories at those sites that can't be told at other sites. Other sites have been selected because they were crucial to the civil rights movement, crucial to the abolitionist movement. And really importantly, there are also sites that tell very painful stories of American history that are very important to remember. Some examples include sites that are important for remembering slavery, for remembering the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, sites that are important for remembering the genocide against Indigenous nations. And it's really important that the signage at all of these sites are preserved because they were chosen so that Americans can understand the full story of American history.
And as I understand it, the way that this project of either covering or removing signs is that visitors to the parks and monuments will report things that they consider to be disparaging to Americans via QR code. Is the nature of whether or not something is disparaging, is that just being left up to those visitors who use the QR code?
You're absolutely correct. There is, of course, no shared definition of what it means to be disparaging. And this is really concerning because not only are these signs being censored, but there's no transparency around which signs might be targeted, what kind of language might be targeted. And that creates a situation where it's very ambiguous which signs will remain up for the public to see.
So, in light of that, do I understand correctly that the goal of the Save Our Signs project is for people who see signs that make reference to some of the historical incidents and moments that you were alluding to earlier, and that they are concerned might be flagged as disparaging by others, that you want them to send them in to you so that there is a record that those signs were once present in case the Department of the Interior decides to remove or cover them?
Yes, that's correct. But we also really welcome pictures of all signs. And one thing that I do want to make really clear about our project is that we are inviting people to take pictures of all signs, and we're not asking people to pass judgment on these signs. Mm-hmm. We really want to preserve all the signs as they are right now. And the reason for that is that these signs were all created by National Park staff, civil servants, whose role, whose job was to tell the story of these sites to the general public. And this is taxpayer-funded work that belongs to all of us.
Yeah. So once the Save Our Signs project went live, I have in my notes here that as of earlier this week, you had already received over 2,400 photo submissions. What kinds of signs are people sending you? Can you give us any examples?
Yeah, and I'm happy to share that as of today, we are up to 2,800.
Okay.
Which we are thrilled about. We are getting signs from all over the country. And something that's been so fun for me is I have learned about national park sites I did not even know existed. Everything from there is a Rosie the Riveter site that people have submitted signs from. Another sign that is featured currently on our website is probably the most famous example in the news right now, as your listeners may know. Last week, some signs were taken down from Muir Woods. There is a long timeline that they have there that was originally put up, I'm not sure at the date, to highlight things that were crucial to the history of conservation in the U.S. And then there have been added to that timeline yellow boxes, they look like post-it notes, that include information that was not initially included in that timeline, including the contributions of women conservationists. And it also includes information about major conservationists that is troubling to learn but really important to know, such as the fact that some conservationists had racist and eugenicist beliefs and that was part of their worldview as well.
I mean, is part of the idea here that at a certain point, if some of these signs are removed, unless a future administration replaces them, there may not necessarily be a record that they were ever there? But
that is exactly correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So through the work that you're doing, there will at least be some sort of repository.
Exactly. And our goal is we will be creating a publicly accessible archive. We will be sharing all of the information we receive about the signs. And we're doing this so that members of the general public can see these signs regardless of what happens to them. And also so that researchers can conduct analysis if signs continue to go down that address some of the questions you're asking, like which signs are being targeted.
Could I ask you, Molly, just in your own opinion, I suppose the assumption of this policy on the part of the administration is that it is somehow bad for Americans to see information that makes reference to what they're calling disparaging information about American history, but is undeniably just things that happened.
Right.
What would your counter be to the idea that those facts are somehow disparaging? What do you think the value of knowing about these histories is?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the simplest way I can put it is that if we as a country don't understand our past and our full past, we can't move forward as a nation in the future. We can't learn from the past. You know, real history is not just happy stories or things that celebrate grandeur. Real history is everything that happened and how all communities that lived in, you know, what is now the United States over the years experienced those events. And that's history that we have the right to access.
Well, Molly Blake is a social sciences librarian at the University of Minnesota and one of the people running the Save Our Signs project. Molly, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the role preachers play when politics come into the pulpit. But first,
it's always alarming when we find out hackers got into our state's election system. It was even more alarming when we realized those hackers were likely connected to Iran. The hack took place late last month. Hackers infiltrated the Arizona Secretary of State's website and switched out photos of candidates with those of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. But what our next guest says could have turned into an opportunity to improve our state's election system instead turned into a political football. Stephen Richer used to run elections in Maricopa County. He is our former county recorder. Now he is a contributing columnist for the Arizona Republic's opinion pages, and he joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Good morning, Stephen. Good morning, Elvia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, Stephen, I want you to kick us off here with a little bit about what happened. Like, how did this hack kind of get co-opted by politics, as you describe it?
I think, unfortunately, thanks to social media, the irony here is that I think it was handled pretty well in that the Secretary of State's office identified the issue. It quickly shut down those pages. It quickly worked with the Arizona Department of Homeland Security to identify the threat. And then on July 1st, it sent out a press release notifying the public, notifying members of the media of exactly what happened. So it wasn't that big of a deal until 2 weeks later, Tyler Boyer of Turning Point USA, a alt-right, Trump-adjacent youth political group, decided to send out a tweet that suggested that it was a big cover-up and that this was a big deal and that Arizona's elections were unsafe. And then based off of that, a bunch of people began piling on, and then it just devolved into normal politics and ugliness.
Right. But as you say, there was no actual threat to voter registration records here.
So what had been targeted was just an informational website, and it couldn't have any impact on any ballots, which are, of course, paper ballots and are unhackable in Arizona. And it didn't have any impact on the voter registration database, which is housed on a very different system from that which houses the informational website.
Right, right. And I want to nail that point home for one more question, because you point this out in the piece, and I think it's an important fact about paper ballots, which people complain about, but they cannot be hacked.
That's part of the beauty of paper ballots. There's lots of downsides to them, but all the security community loves paper ballots because they create a auditable paper trail that absolutely cannot be hacked. You can't hack paper.
Elvia, let me turn to you and ask you about the political turn that this all took. Does this surprise you, given the last couple of years, maybe more than that, we've had when it comes to elections in our state?
No, it's a political opportunity for the alt-right, and that's why it doesn't surprise me at all. You know, for one, I am happy that you asked that question about the paper ballot. I loved how Stephen here wrote paper ballot almost in every line here in the column. And I love that way, you know, to over-communicate, and I think that's a message here. Again, it looks like the Secretary of State did everything right, informed the public, sent out a press release to reporters, but then we have a whole section of the population that just doesn't trust the election because there are certain people that have made it their personal life and career and fortunes trying to sell the point that distrust about the elections. And so they take every opportunity, whether it is truth or not, to try to erode further distrust in the election system. And so this is one of the things that happened here. So no, it doesn't surprise me whatsoever. So the lessons here for me are to over-communicate, although again, the Secretary of State apparently did communicate it as they should have, but not enough.
Hmm. Stephen, you talk about how this could have been used as an opportunity. What would you have rather seen happen? Like, how could this have been useful to the state?
We could have revisited how much information should be shared with whom and when. We could have used it as an opportunity to further strengthen the connections between the Federal Department of Homeland Security, the Arizona Department of Homeland Security, Arizona's state-based cyber systems, cyber security programs. And we could have used it as an opportunity to talk about why our elections are built to withstand something like a targeted attack at a website from a foreign adversary, in this case, Iran. Mm-hmm. Instead, like all things political or adjacent to politics, it turned into an opportunity to score points, use histrionics, and hopefully get some follows on social media. And what really makes me sad about this isn't even as much the attack on elections. It's just that that is the type of behavior that seems to be rewarded in today's politics rather than the quiet efforts to make a system better, as was apparently done by multiple Republican state legislators who met earlier in the month,
right,
prior to Boyer's tweet, with the secretary to try and understand the situation and brainstorm solutions.
Elvia, what does all of this do to the kind of continuing erosion of trust in our elections?
Well, it tells me that still we have a lot to do. We have been talking about elections for years here in Maricopa County, and Stephen has done a fantastic job, did a great job communicating and again, over-communicating. But still, I don't think that the public understand how elections work. After all this many years of talking about it, for instance, the first thing that I saw everywhere was that the Secretary of State website has been hacked, mm-hmm, as if there was only one page. And Stephen made it very clear in the column here that there are different servers, different pages, different places where you store the election information, and we oversimplify things, and by we meaning we the journalists as well and the people that are trying to capitalize on this. So yeah, the public still doesn't understand how elections are really run.
That's interesting. Stephen, let me ask you lastly before I let you go. Are there real problems in our state's election security that we should be talking about that we're not?
I think as long as we have people who want to destabilize American democracy, then we will have real threats. There will be actors like Iran who will try to target websites that are connected to the internet because that's a portal through which they can enter. And they might try to do stuff like take down websites that tell you where you can go to vote. And that's a very real threat. Mm. But I think the greater threat to American elections and Arizona elections right now is unfortunately homegrown. from actors who, as Elvia says, have a financial interest in continuing to sow seeds of widespread doubt in our election system and could potentially lead to people just not believing in our elections and therefore not believing that the people who are in office have real authority.
All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Stephen Richer, former Maricopa County recorder, contributing columnist to the Arizona Republic, joining Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor. Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Talks are taking place this week in Geneva, Switzerland, in an effort to come to agreement on a global treaty on plastics. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewen. And Jonathan, this is not the first time countries have taken up this issue, but the last round of negotiations ended last December without a deal.
That's right. More than 200 countries met in South Korea towards the end of last year seeking a landmark agreement on tackling plastic pollution. But the countries failed to reach agreement owing to deep divisions between a group of nearly 100 so-called high ambition countries, which called for plastics to be phased out, and oil producing nations who warned this would affect the world's development. Back in 2022, the world's nations agreed that a global treaty was required to tackle the issue of plastic pollution, particularly the impact on the marine environment. And they gave themselves 2 years to get it sorted, given the urgency of the issue. Now, obviously, those 2 years have come and gone and not a great deal of progress has been made. Since 1950, more than 8 billion tons of plastic have been produced globally, but only around a tenth of that has been recycled, meaning millions of tons have entered the world's oceans and seas, posing serious risks to wildlife and their environment. And it's worth keeping in mind that plastic is produced from fossil fuels and is currently estimated to be responsible for around 5% of global emissions. So efforts to restrict it could also help with the challenge of tackling climate change.
Well, so Jonathan, given the failure of the last round of talks, is there realistically much chance of an agreement at this round?
Well, I think there's a degree more optimism than there was in December, when the key split was over something called Article 6 on whether there should be a commitment to cutting how much plastic's produced or just try and reduce plastic waste by increasing efforts to recycle. There's a group of 95 nations, including the European Union, UK, African group, and many South American nations who called for Article 6 to be a legally binding pledge to reduce production levels. But a group of oil producing nations, including Saudi Arabia, Iran, Kuwait and Russia, pushed back strongly. The context is that the demand for oil across most sectors is expected to fall from 2026 as countries move to cleaner technologies like electric vehicles. But plastic is seen as one of the remaining growth markets. So we'll have to see how things progress in the talks. But there have been calls from environmentalists, if talks don't make progress, for the 95 countries that are able to agree on reducing plastic production to go ahead with their own treaty. That may be the next step if progress isn't made in the coming weeks.
That's interesting. All right, Jonathan, let's go now to Moscow, where the trial of 19 suspects gets underway. That's related to the Krokus City Hall attacks in March of last year, which left almost 150 people dead. Can you remind us of the background on this story?
Yeah, the attack on a Moscow concert hall on March the 22nd last year was the worst in Russia for years. Just days after President Putin began his fifth term of office, gunmen stormed the complex, killing at least 145 people and injuring more than 500. The Islamic State group said four of its members carried out the attack. It involved a shooting in the foyer, then in the concert hall, and additionally, the attackers used a flammable liquid to set fire to the concert hall's premises. Helicopters were brought in at the time to drop more than 150 tons of water, but it took hours for the fire to be contained. And those who carried out the attack managed to escape the inferno and mayhem that they left behind. But within 14 hours, 11 suspects had been arrested. Four of them appeared in court a couple of days later, all of whom were from Tajikistan.
And Jonathan, at the time, Russia tried to blame Ukraine for the attack, right?
Yeah, that's right. Despite IS claiming responsibility, Vladimir Putin went on television in the aftermath of the attack and said, quote, based on preliminary information, a window for crossing the border was prepared for the attackers by the Ukrainian side. Now, Ukraine dismissed those claims as absolutely untenable and absurd. But in the wake of the attack, Russian officials amplified the claim regardless. It's worth noting that a couple of weeks before the atrocity, the US had warned of a potential attack targeting large gatherings in Moscow. At the time, a Russian official complained that US intelligence lacked specific detail. And a week before the attack, Vladimir Putin weighed in, saying recent provocative statements by a number of official Western structures about the possibility of terrorist attacks in Russia resembles outright blackmail and an intention to intimidate and destabilize our society. Meanwhile, it would be interesting to see whether the claims by Russia of Ukrainian involvement are still being made during the course of the trial in the coming days.
All right. So, Jonathan, finally, let's go to Poland now, where that country's new president will be sworn in on Wednesday. Now, while it's a largely ceremonial role, the new president could still be somewhat of a thorn in the side of Prime Minister Donald Tusk's governing coalition, right?
Yeah, that's right. The president-elect Karol Nawrocki's supporters, the Law and Justice opposition, feel re-energized after losing power a year and a half ago to Prime Minister Donald Tusk's pro-EU coalition. Mr. Nawrocki beat the liberal Warsaw mayor Rafał Trzaskowski by a slender 51-49% margin in the June 1st presidential runoff, and Law and Justice see that victory as the first step towards a return to power. Poland's president has limited influence on foreign and defence policy, but can propose and crucially veto bills. Donald Tusk's government lacks a big enough parliamentary majority to overturn a presidential veto. The outgoing Conservative president, Andrzej Duda, repeatedly used his blocking powers and the threat of using them to prevent the prime minister from delivering on many of his key campaign promises, including giving Polish women the right to a legal abortion up until the 12th week of pregnancy, legalizing civil partnerships, including same-sex relationships, and removing political influence from the judiciary. And Karol Nawrocki is expected to be an even tougher opponent for Donald Tusk than Andrzej Duda.
So can you tell us a little bit more about Karol Nawrocki's background and political positions?
Well, he's a 42-year-old socially conservative historian. He's a Catholic who opposes illegal migration, extending legal rights to people in same-sex relationships, and liberalizing the country's strict abortion law. He believes Donald Tusk's vision of cementing Poland in the European Union mainstream by relying on good relations with Brussels, Berlin, and Paris runs counter to Polish national interests. He says those interests are best served by standing up to Germany when their opinions diverge and not ceding more power to Brussels. He does support continued military and humanitarian assistance to neighboring Ukraine, and Poland is home to the international hub for supplies to Kyiv. But he doesn't believe that Ukraine joining either NATO or the EU, whilst Russian aggression is ongoing, would enhance Poland's security. He's also a supporter of Donald Trump and criticized the approach taken by Ukraine's President Zelensky in that infamous Oval Office dressing down. And he received an endorsement from the US Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, who flew to Poland a few days before the election. So interesting times ahead for politics in Poland.
It sure seems like it. All right. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you too, Mark.
And now it's time to meet the next maker in our series, Made in Arizona.
I could take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risks in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot.
Dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings. I try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time.
In this case, let's meet our next makers. Adriana Quintero and Luz Violeta are a mother-daughter team and the force behind Machica Colectivo, a family-run group that creates contemporary jewelry using traditional beadwork, and they teach others how to do it. They're members of the indigenous Mexican Wirarica culture, and they see the beadwork and the way you methodically make it as almost a form of prayer. The collective teaches workshops and sells its wares to help support the community. My co-host, I spoke with them more about it.
Mexico, you know, is very colorful and art is everywhere. Mm-hmm. For me, art is the inspiration. I want to start with art will heal the world.
Tell me about growing up and making jewelry like this. Did you learn how to make it as a kid?
I was in my teenager age because same as here, as United States, the reservations are in certain places. Mm-hmm. Then I grew up when I was little away of the reservation.
Yeah.
Then when I was a teenager, I just start looking for my traditions.
So you didn't grow up on the reservation. So as a teenager, you tried to find some of that culture. And this was part of that, it sounds like.
Yes. Yes. Just yeah. like that. And I found it.
Yeah.
And I found my brother, my sisters, and all that beautiful world that is all about all origin.
Yeah. So you're a mother-daughter pair here, and you work together in this collective making this jewelry. Luz, tell me about your experience in learning about this and learning about your culture in that way.
So really, I'm so fortunate to have grown up with these practices. It's something that has just been a part of my upbringing and that has given me a sense of purpose and a mission in life. And so I'm really, really grateful that my mom was already on that path, on that journey to reconnecting and rediscovering where we really come from, so that by the time I was born, I was born with a really deep sense of identity and of culture and tradition. And it's taken me really far. I really think it's kept me grounded and kept my head on my shoulders through a lot of difficult moments. And it's also helped me to grow as a person, to establish myself as an artist here in Arizona. You know, I also was born in Mexico, and we moved here together when I was about 9 years old. So it's something that has stuck with us even through all of these ups and downs and across borders. And it's kept us connected not just to our traditions, but to our family back home and to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell me about the beading, right? This is what's called sacred geometries that you're kind of replicating in the beading. What does that mean? There are stars, hummingbirds, eclipses, designs that we all know, but they mean something a little different to you.
Yeah, it's a language of light because native art in the beginning was a way to communicate with a spiritual world. Then our ancestors, if they wanted to communicate with the spiritual, you know, we need rain. Then we start making different patterns about water. It's more about being thankful. No asking, it's just to maintain the harmony and let them know to the spiritual world that we are grateful to be here and we are grateful for the water, grateful for the fire, grateful for the air.
So it sounds like when you're beading, it's almost like a prayer.
Yes.
Yes. I like to say that beading is a way of telling a story with your hands. It's very much an expression of your inner world, and it's as much about the process as it is about the final product. So it's really a journey, and it's something that as you have your hands in the beadwork and you're making a piece, you are cycling through those emotions and expressing that inner world that comes out in the form of a pattern and colors and the different designs, the sacred geometries that come out from within us.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it.
Yeah, and that's the healing part, because if you have emotions that are not found in the way to go through, then when you put your hands in art, any kind, but we use beading, then you heal yourself.
Yeah. So what does it feel like when you're doing this? Does it feel like a meditation? Does it feel like a catharsis?
Yes, I would say so, especially when you've been practicing the same pattern and trying to make something new or evolve that pattern. It's a connection with culture, with creativity itself. And really, it's very empowering to have that outlet. So, yeah, it feels healing.
And it can be, you can feel frustration.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
It's frustrating. Okay.
Yeah, so in the beginning, when you try to put your mind in the present moment, that may a little uncomfortable feeling, but that's part of the process.
Yeah.
When I learned to make this, it was kind of in the downtimes that we had right before or after in between a ceremony. And so my grandmother, she would come up to me with a needle and beads and thread, and she'd be like, okay, this is how you do this pattern. And the first one that we learned as little kids is making the bracelets.
Okay.
So they're very thin bracelets. And she taught me a very simple pattern that looked like a snake.
Okay.
And snakes are kind of, they've been a favorite of mine lately, I would say. I really like to make these waterfall earrings.
They're beautiful, yeah.
But it's taken time. I mean, you can ask our students when they first sit down and feel that frustration. They can really appreciate, you come to really appreciate when I first made that little bracelet. You know, I just really appreciated, like, my grandma, she made these great big medallions and flowers and just like 3D works that I'm still learning to make. Even now I'm 25 and I've got a long way to go.
Lots to learn.
Yes, I've got a long way to go. I've only mastered really just a few patterns.
Right. It's infinity universe of patterns.
Right.
Never end. Never. Mm-hmm. Never.
So you're teaching people in these workshops how to do this, mm-hmm. which is a gift in itself, I'm sure. What does it feel like to get this into the world, not just in selling these pieces and having other people appreciate them, but in teaching others how to do it?
It's a call. Hmm. It's a call that you have to attend, because if not, it's like a, you know, you have something to share, then you have to do it. It's not an option.
The workshops are not just a teaching space. They're a gathering space.
Yeah.
So it's an intergenerational practice, you know, with mother, daughter, and I'm a mother as well. So I'm very eager and committed to continuing this. To creating spaces of cultural resilience, of sustainability, a place where we can appreciate beauty and human expression, especially being able to share it with people who might feel disconnected from their roots. This is an invitation to, it's like a gateway to get back to that and to reconnect.
Yeah. All right. That is Luz Violeta and her mother, Adriana Quintero, joining us to talk more about their work. Thank you both so much for coming in. I really appreciate it. It was wonderful to meet you.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A study done earlier this year by researchers at ASU and Boston College found nearly 90% of religious leaders believe in human-caused climate change, and a majority believe humans play a major role. But about half of those leaders said they never talked about the issue in their sermons. A quarter only mentioned it once or twice. So how and when do clergy members decide to discuss issues that could be seen as divisive or controversial in their congregations? To find out, I spoke with the Reverend Dr. J. Augustine, senior pastor at Big Bethel AME Church in Atlanta. He also teaches at Hampton University and is the author of the 2023 book, When Prophets Preach, Leadership and the Politics of the Pulpit. And we started with Pastor Augustine's internal thought process when it comes to these kinds of issues, of whether he should talk about them and then how to do so if he decides to.
So it is a deliberative process. Introspectively, it's very deliberative. Number one, I have to follow a moral compass. So the prophet, to go to the title of the book, the prophet is someone who speaks out. We like to say speak truth to power. I oftentimes like to think of it as speaking truth to institutions of power. When one does that, inevitably, it is going to rally some and it's going to alienate others. So you have to pick and choose your battles. You're never going to make anyone happy when you do something that's out of the norm. Never going to make everybody happy when you do something that's out of the norm. In my case, the moral compass for me is when something just does not sit right, when it viscerally goes against my moral upbringing, when it viscerally goes against my theological beliefs. As a pastor, especially a pastor in the Black church tradition that has a rich history of providing prophetic leadership to address social issues or social injustices, I feel compelled to move and to act.
So is your goal to bring issues to the attention of your congregants? Is it to move them to act? Like what are you trying to achieve by bringing up some of these issues?
So again, they are, in my humble estimation, certain actions by governmental officials, certain actions by corporations necessitate a response. When you look back at prophetic leadership, tracing it certainly through the Old Testament narratives, certainly tracing it through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the New Testament narratives that focus on Jesus, the role of the prophet really has been responsive or reactive, opposed to proactive. So my goal is really, number one, to enlighten issues that may harm people, enlighten others about issues that may have a detrimental impact to a section or a segment of society, those who have been pushed to the margins. That's part of what I feel called to do. So again, the prophet is not someone who's looking for the platform, but the prophet is someone who's got to take the platform when social circumstances demand such.
I'm wondering if you've had conversations with colleagues in other churches or other houses of worship where maybe they would like to speak out about something or feel compelled to speak out about something, but for whatever reason don't feel like they can or don't feel comfortable doing so. I'm curious, like, what those conversations with you are like, how you're maybe able to counsel them.
Yeah, I have many friends in varied denominations who have been in spaces where they have shared, I want to, but I'm afraid. I'm paraphrasing here. I'm afraid because of my livelihood. There was an issue very recently in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the gentleman's name escapes me. And I believe I actually have had the pleasure of meeting him before. But someone who would stand up, someone who would speak out, someone who would from the pulpit try to engage the congregation in social injustices, matters that the good book that we read, the narratives that portray Christ as someone who was an advocate for those who were marginalized, opposed to someone who was a part of an institution that would do the marginalizing, right? That gentleman spoke out, and regrettably, through whatever ecclesial process they have, he was relieved of his pastorate. That certainly has not been the case with my faith tradition, my denomination, or the congregations within the denomination that I have been blessed to serve.
Have you ever had instances where maybe you're talking about a particular issue where on a broad level, people in your congregation agree, but maybe there are differences of opinion about how we got to a particular place or what the solutions might be or what actions should be taken?
Sure. So again, I serve in the Black church tradition, and people categorically reference the Black church, but I want to be clear that it is not a monolith. All hearts and minds are not always on the same accord when we talk about political issues or about partisan issues. Mm-hmm. I attempt to follow a moral compass that leads me in the right way, and I believe if that's the way God would have me to go, that others will be there with me, and certainly that has been my experience. But let's be clear, I have had talks with some parishioners over the years that have said, Pastor, I just can't get down with the politics. I just can't get down with this. I can't get down with the other. Just tell me what Jesus said. And I would affectionately retort that, you know, again, when I read the good book, what Jesus said was always political. What Jesus said was always something speaking out on behalf of or being a champion of those who had been pushed to the social margins by the hierarchical power structures in which he lived. I'm not talking in our context about somebody putting on a red hat and saying I'm with Team R, or putting on a blue hat and saying I'm with Team D. I'm talking about moral issues that should ignite us all to have a passion similar to the passion Christ had in wanting to liberate and wanting to engage and wanting to bring people from the social margins into the mainstay, opposed to alienating others.
Beyond your experience and the specific churches that you have been ministering to, what do you think is the responsibility of a clergy member in whatever faith tradition they're in to sort of take the pulse of their congregation, to have a sense of where their congregants stand before talking about some of these issues, regardless of what the clergy member believes? Like, is it important for, a clergy member in a particular church or mosque or synagogue to really know how their message is going to land before they try to deliver it?
I think so. I think part is, number one, you have to know where you are. And when you talk metaphorically speaking or figuratively speaking about the pulpit where you are, you have to understand the people you've been called or sent to serve. I am fortunate, again, not just from an internal perspective from my own congregations, but to your point about friends who are clergy leaders, I am very active in interfaith ministry. Not just ecumenical ministry, again, not just Christians, but in ministries where I work very closely with several rabbis, very closely with imams. And these are individuals who I share kindred spirits. We share a concern for public good in our respective congregations. So the social justice lens of being a prophetic leader, of being a prophetic pastor, a prophetic imam, or a prophetic rabbi, that has been a common thread that has been active, certainly in my interactions with others who are concerned about justice in their respective pulpits. But to your point, it certainly does begin with understanding those you are sent to or called to serve.
Reverend Augustine, thank you so much. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
The Reverend Dr. J. Augustine is senior pastor at Big Bethel AME Church in Atlanta, also author of the 2023 book, When Prophets Preach, Leadership, and the Politics of the Pulpit. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.